Welcome, members and guests, to the June 20th program of the City Club of Eugene. Greetings to our broadcast audiences on community television, and thanks to all of you for joining us. Our program today is Meeting the Needs of Lane County's Newly Insured. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club's president for 2014 and 15. A special thank you to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the broadcasts on their website. Our sponsors today are Evans, Elder & Brown, Commercial Real Estate, Oakley Meadow Co-Housing, an intergenerational community designed for simple, sustainable living, and PAC Info, Internet Solutions. And for supplying our office space, we thank KPFF Consulting Engineers. A quick reminder that these programs are free for our listening audience, but it does cost real money to produce them and a lot of volunteer effort. Your contributions are most welcome and completely tax deductible. Our program today, coordinated by Marty Wilde, takes a look at the collaborative medical systems being developed for Lane County's newly insured. Some 30,000 residents in Lane County alone now have new health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. One of the biggest challenges, as we'll hear, is finding primary care physicians to serve these newly insured residents. Our presenters today are Debbie Farr, Public Relations Specialist at Trillium Community Health Plan, Dr. Patrick Ludke, Medical Director for the Lane County Public Health Department, and Dr. Rick Kincaid, Vice President of Medical Affairs for Community-Based Services at Peace Health. Please join me in welcoming them to the podium.
We had to recruit a helper to advance the slides since we don't have a remote. I thought it would be helpful to give you a little timeline of healthcare reform before we start talking about access to primary care. How's that? So healthcare reform began with H.R. 3590. President Obama signed it into law on March 23rd, 2010. It's been called by many acronyms, the PPACA or the ACA. We love acronyms in healthcare. Many call it the most significant piece of reform to pass in this century. Critics called it a lot of things, but they dubbed it Obamacare, which was picked up by mainstream media. I like what President Obama had to say about that. He said in an interview, "I like it, I don't mind. And I tell you, 5 years from now, when everybody's saying, I'm sure glad we got health care, there's going to be a whole bunch of people who don't call it Obamacare anymore because they don't want me to get the credit." So moving on with the timeline, in 2011, the legislature approved health system transformation. And then in 2012, they created what are called coordinated care organizations. Trillium is one of 15 coordinated care organizations in this state that are located regionally that provide access to health care for members of the Oregon Health Plan. So the next step in healthcare reform, once we got CCOs underway and we integrated behavioral health and dental care, and you can advance to the next slide, Craig, was Medicaid expansion. So January 1st, 2014, 26 states, including Oregon and Washington, D.C., expanded their Medicaid program. And what that did is that increased eligibility to 138% of federal poverty guidelines. And you can see what that amounts to on the screen, $16,100 a year for a single person or $32,900 a year for a family of four. And also children from families that are at or below 300% of FPL are eligible now for the Oregon Health Plan. Since January 1st, almost 350,000 Oregonians have signed up for the Oregon Health Plan. So now many people that lacked access to health care before now have access available to them. The Oregon Health Authority provided estimates to all of the CCOs, which gave us a number of what we could expect in terms of new Oregon Health Plan enrollment by the end of 2015. And the number that they gave Trillium was 27,000. You can go to the next slide, Craig. Access to health care? Are you there? Great. I'll keep turning around so I don't miss the slides. Trillium actually has received 32,000 new Oregon health plan members from January 1st to date. That was a huge influx of members that we didn't anticipate, and it's completely overwhelmed the provider base. We've been able to assign most of those new members to a primary care provider, but about 10,000 remained unassigned. April 1st, Trillium had to close to new Oregon health plan members for medical, and what we have been able to do is continue to provide access for mental health and dental because we did have capacity. But about 4,000 new Oregon health plan members now receive their medical care through what's called Oregon Health Authority Open Card Fee for Service. So the state provides that service for them. We're working right now internally to identify pregnant women because we do have capacity for obstetrics, and the state is working on a workaround within their system to identify children because we do have capacity for pediatrics. So we expect that unassigned number will go down. So why is it that we have this issue with primary care? We've got a shortage of primary care providers in Lane County. Fewer physicians are choosing primary care. The reason for that is they can earn more as specialists, they have more flexibility in their schedule, and also nationally, which Oregon mirrors, about 50% of all primary care providers are at or near retirement age. So Trillium has some short and intermediate term strategies that we've employed. We created what we call the Access to Care Plan. Number one is to increase capacity by offering additional payments for new OHP members. You're good, Craig. The second is providing a grant to Lane County for the 5th Community Health Center, which is opening in West Eugene on August 25th. That will provide access to about 6,000 new OHP adults. The third is a request for proposals to clinics or provider groups willing to accept 5,000 new adult OHP members, and then working with an organization called TransferMed, which actually will be able to increase efficiency and workflow in primary care offices. They're in the process of working with 13 local clinics right now. They've made their initial practice assessments. Our long-term strategies are to develop a residency program in Lane County. We're working with our federal delegation to leverage federal dollars. The Balanced Budget Act of 1999 reduced these funds, and we do have interest locally in starting a residency program, but financially there are a lot of barriers unless we can get federal funding. Also, an organized effort in recruitment and retention. There are incentives available, and if we put together a local team that can go to medical schools and talk about these incentives as well as healthcare reform in Oregon and what it offers to a provider, we believe that that will help increase interest in primary care. And then we're working with our educational entities, Lane Community College, University of Oregon, Oregon Health Science University, and Comp Northwest, so that we can develop new programs that will help open access to primary care. I just want to leave you with one brief quote before I pass the baton over to my colleagues. Gandhi said, "You must be the change you wish to see in the world." And President Obama followed by saying, "Change will not come if you wait for some other person or some other time. We're the ones we've been waiting for. We are the change we seek."
I'm Dr. Patrick Ludke. I'm the Chief Medical Officer of the Federally Qualified Health Center Clinics, which are clinics that exist within Lane County's Department of Health and Human Services. And I'm going to talk a bit about our clinical footprint currently and as well as our footprint moving forward. So next slide, please. Very good. Currently, we operate a behavioral health clinic, which cares for patients with severe and persistent mental illness in our county. There's roughly about 1,200 of those patients, and we operate four primary care clinics. Three of those are freestanding clinics, and one is actually integrated with that behavioral health clinic. We have about 25 providers spread across those clinics. Of interest, I think, is our current mix of patients. About 60% of all of our patients are already on Medicaid. That number has crept up a little bit with health reform implementation this year. But the vast majority of our income is from Medicaid patients. We don't receive any tax dollars from Lane County citizens. We bill for the patients that we see, and we get almost all of our income from Medicaid patients. We do have a grant to be a federally qualified health center, representing about 10% of our total budget. Also interesting is a vast majority of our patients are at or below the federal poverty level, 93% of which are at the 200% federal poverty level or below. And in terms of total patients and encounters, as of the present time, we have 24,200 unique patients, and last year that involved roughly 100,000 patient encounters at our clinics. Next slide, please. So as Debbie mentioned, we're part of the four-part plan to address these 30,000 newly insured in our county, and one of the things that the county is doing is opening up a new clinic. That clinic will open in late August. The target date right now is August 25th. We're calling it Brookside Clinic. If you want the full title, it'll be the Community Health Centers of Lane County, Brookside. It's a little too unwieldy. It'll be very near the 18th and Chambers intersection, roughly at about 17th and Chambers, actually. And it's a remodel of an existing building. There is a clinic there presently. We're remodeling one of the facilities on that footprint. We envision it to have four primary care providers. We have 2.5 of them hired at present. We're actively recruiting. If you know anyone who's looking for a primary care job, please, I'll give you my phone number after this meeting, and maybe we'll put it up on the radio station. This is envisioned as full-spectrum primary care, focusing on adults, so there won't be pediatrics at this site, and our goal is to take 6,000 of those currently unassigned, roughly 10 or 11,000 that Debbie spoke of. Next slide, please. There's a couple other things that we can do in our existing clinic footprint to try to free up some capacity. One is to look internally, what can we do with internal efficiencies, and the other is external, what can we do with our collaborators, with our partners out in the community. And under the internal efficiency banner, Debbie mentioned practice transformation. There is a national entity out there that is working with almost 1,000 practices now, I believe, to try to help them move forward with internal efficiencies to free up more space for patient access. We will be working with this company. It's called TransferMed over the ensuing year. In addition, there's a variety of care coordination initiatives. You've probably heard of the patient-centered medical home. It's not only providing a home for the patient, but providing this continuous continuity of care across a disparate number of footprints of clinical care, so medical and dental and surgical, behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse, trying to link all of those services together. There's also some other internal efficiencies in terms of having existing employees work at a higher level of their license so that providers, be they nurse practitioners or physician assistants or physicians, are only doing the really highly value-added work that requires their license and not doing some of the other work that could be done by someone without a license. Excuse me, I have a bit of an allergy today. Next slide, please. So external efficiencies, there's a few areas that I'll discuss briefly, and I think Rick's going to pick on a couple of them as well. Those of you who have probably seen a physician or other provider at some point in time have wondered how your medical records, your post-operative discharge note got to your primary care doc. How does that work? In the olden days with paper charts, that didn't work quite as well as we wanted it to. Or olden days using snail mail, that took some time, and you may have had one or two or three visits with your primary care doc before you ever got the note from your surgeon or your cancer specialist. Nowadays, there are many opportunities for that to be much more seamless and almost real time. So using technology and using shared care plans so everyone knows what other providers are doing with that patient is something we're looking at very clearly. There are a variety of upstream prevention initiatives. If you think of healthcare and the patient burden as really a bathtub full of water, there's two ways to address the water level. There's one to turn off the spigot so you don't put any more patients in, and the other might be to drain it out and make them healthy. So we talk about upstream prevention and sort of turn off that spigot so we make people healthier. A lot of that is upstream policy work with the legislature. Some of it is systems and environmental change that can be done at the county and the city level. We're looking at that a great deal, especially in the public health arena. And along those same lines, we talk about CHAs and CHIPs. And I'm hoping that most of you have heard of our Community Health Improvement Plan. That's our CHIP. And I'm hoping some of you participated in what led to the Community Health Improvement Plan, which is the CHA, the Community Health Assessment. We went out and did a whole bunch of assessments with a whole bunch of different organizations, ranging from school to business to government, et cetera, trying to understand what most of our citizens believe are the significant problems, health problems that can be addressed. And we came up with a community health improvement plan from that, and since July of last year, we've been implementing that, addressing some of the biggest problems. So I'm going to stop there and pass the baton to Dr. Kincaid.
Thank you, Pat. It's a pleasure to speak with you today. I'm Rick Kincaid. I'm a family physician with Peace Health Medical Group. And part of the reason that we're here together is because this is a challenge with respect to caring for the vulnerable that we've taken on as a community. Okay, very good. So again, as we've looked at the importance of creating the CCO, which is a coordinated care organization, it really is to do a community-wide effort to try to care for the vulnerable. And Peace Health, being the largest provider of hospital-based care, accounts for about 85% of the hospital care that occurs within Lane County. We have four facilities, so we also cover Cottage Grove and Florence as part of the CCO, and also have medical group. But I'm going to try to give you a little bit of perspective from the part of the community that has really made a commitment to the rest of this work. And that includes also my colleagues from Oregon Medical Group, as well as the Lane independent providers, primary care providers, also are at the table and are a key part of this. In addition, our behavioral health community that has made a very concerted effort. As we look at the CCO, it isn't just about traditional family medicine, internal medicine. It's really about an integrated care model that Pat was talking about. So this is a collaborative effort that goes across many areas in order to try to meet this need. So when we, what I'd like to do is just take a few minutes to address how we're looking at particularly the primary care shortage, which is what led us here today to have this discussion, and really what I consider to be a perfect storm. So go ahead, Craig. So the reality is that the perfect storm has to do with the fact that we've had a large number of providers, as Debbie mentioned, who are at or nearing retirement. And so we, many of us came to the community 30 years or more ago, and as such are nearing the beach of retirement. And those folks, when the economy improved, decided that was the best time to land on the beach. And so over the last couple of years, we've lost 30 or more primary care providers from our community, and because for good reason. They're moving on and being able to enjoy their retired lives. But what that does is it creates a shortage, relative shortage, that we need to deal with. And so many of us have really made concerted efforts in a variety of areas to try to address that shortage. The first is that of retention, sort of keeping as many providers in the community as humanly possible. Second is really recruitment, getting new providers, and then redesigning the care model that Pat mentioned to try to sort of spread the existing providers as far as we can. And the last thing is really trying to build a sustainable workforce that is not just a physician workforce, but a workforce of a team-based model, which includes behavioral health specialist, it includes nurses, it includes pharmacy, it includes a whole variety of other providers in a team-based model. So, Craig, if you could move it on. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is provider retention, and Pat mentioned a couple of the things. We have tried to create as many creative models to try to keep providers present, and much of that has to do with part-time employment. Many, as you know, over half of the providers coming out of training now are women, and as such aren't willing to commit every single hour of the day to practice of medicine and have a good work-life balance, unlike many of their male counterparts who probably don't have that good sense. So the reality is that we have a workforce that now has many part-time providers try to balance that. So it takes more than one provider to equal a retiring provider. And so that's a challenge. But we have to create those environments. They have to have the ability to have part-time employment. Be a part of a group that can do that. We also need to make sure that we fully staff the model so we support those types of practices. So we've made efforts to do that and try to accommodate schedules. We have a variety of providers at my medical group that have kids that have to get out of school at 3 o'clock. So that means they may start a little earlier, end a little earlier, so they can be home for their kids. So you have to create those sort of environments. And we need to support spouses. So we're also working to try to make sure that we have good networks of support, particularly for our newer providers who are trying to enter into the community and try to provide those sort of supports. And then we need to just make sure we do good education development. So as far as recruitment, good news as the shortage is that many of our groups have been successful. I list the 12 new primary care providers that will be starting up here over the next couple, 3 months at Peace Health Medical Group. But it's also occurred at the community health centers. We've been able to recruit new providers, and we've also been able to recruit providers both at Oregon Medical Group and in our independent provider association. So we are successful. Have been successful in recruiting, but again, that important piece of keeping those folks here is going to be really important. So we are going to need help, and we've had several good collaborative efforts to make, particularly creating spousal employment, which is a very important part. A lot of times folks come and they may have a spouse that needs a job, and so we've worked collaboratively with the community to make that happen. We also need to understand the care model is changing, and again, it won't be as physician-centric. It's also going to include what we call advanced practice clinicians, which includes physician assistants and nurse practitioners that will provide much of primary care. So really trying to work with the training programs to make sure we have a pipeline of those folks. And we've all made efforts to try to keep our salaries competitive. There are many parts of the country that pay substantially more for these types of providers. So even though Eugene and Lane County are a fabulous place to live, folks need to service their debt. They need to be able, they're coming out, the average medical student comes out with $250,000 of debt. So in order to service that debt, you have to have employment that's able to do that. So we've really worked hard at trying to do that. We've also partnered with the state in loan forgiveness programs. The other piece is redesigning the care model. And Pat already talked about that to a certain degree. Again, we call a primary care medical home, patient-centered primary care medical home. Across the board, our community and primary care has embraced that concept. And again, that means embedded behavioral health. So folks that are able to deal with those issues in behavioral health in the moment, pharmacy support, from a social service aspect. Many of our patients, particularly in the Medicaid population, have some significant challenges in their lives, and so we work very hard to try to support them in as many ways as possible. We also are creating different ways to provide care, so particularly virtual care. And virtual care, again, can be, as you noticed, I have a 17-year-old, and literally she has the most dexterous thumbs that I can imagine. And a lot of folks, they get all of their information, all of their connection on a device. So how is it that we make sure the information is available? How can we create other venues for care? And so that's what we call virtual care. Many people will call it telemedicine. We are also able to provide specialty support. Peace Health provides telepsychiatry for Florence. So when an issue comes up in Florence in our crisis center, they're able to talk, quote unquote, to a behavioral health specialist that actually is sitting here in Eugene, but they're right in front of them on the screen, and so they can have an interaction. So we create other ways to try to spread our workforce a little bit farther. And last thing is really that I'd like to go through is really building that sustainable workforce, and that really has to do with training. What we call residencies, which are additional training for primary care, behavioral health, and others. We go to medical school for 4 years just to talk about doctors, and then we typically have anywhere from 3 to 6 years of additional training before we actually start practice. And so how do we create those environments here? Currently, we don't have residency programs here. We do have some residents that do some rotations, but we don't have a residency program within directly within our community, and that is an opportunity that we're spending some effort looking at. We also want to make sure we can train up the nurse practitioners and PA workforce that's necessary, and so we're looking at what our options are to do that in partnership, particularly with OHSU, but also with other programs across the state. So this is going to mean partnerships. So we're already spending a lot of time working with the U of O, certainly with LCC and their training programs. They've been extremely valuable in creating a whole new workforce called the community health worker, which is a lay navigator that's been very helpful. So we want to make sure we accelerate those things. And so we're also working at the state level to try to provide funding. So I just got back from Salem just now, and that was one of the topics we were at the Capitol that we have been discussing, is how can we increase funding to these training programs across the state and not just in Portland. So these are things that we have to do. So the last slide I just want to, again, is sort of a challenge to this group and to our community, is that community problems require community solutions. And when we look at both provision of care for the vulnerable, reality is it's going to require community solutions. And that it does look like the partnerships. It does look like our connection with the business community. Healthcare is very tied to the viability of the business community as well. And then advocacy. So we ask that you would continue to be good, strong advocates for our healthcare delivery system here in Lane County and be able to speak the language that would help our legislators to understand how important it is to have great care here in Lane County. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll break for a few minutes to help the tables formulate their questions and then be back.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the June 20th City Club program, Meeting the Medical Needs of Lane County's Newly Insured. Our guest speakers are Dr. Rick Kincaid, Dr. Patrick Ludke, and Debbie Farr. You may direct your questions to any or all of them. Thank you.
Arnold Ismack, a healthy City Club member since 1998. During your presentations, it was mentioned that there is a shortage of nurses and primary care physicians, but none of you came up with an answer to the problem. What is being done and what can be done to attract more people into nursing and primary care medicine?
I'm going to go ahead and take that question. I think you hit the nail on the head in that is a critical issue. As we've seen the decrease in the number of particularly physicians that have chosen primary care residency programs, it has been for several reasons. The primary reason, again, as I mentioned before, has been the accelerating debt structure of the average medical education. When I went to medical school, embarrassingly, over three decades ago, I paid $200 a quarter for my medical school education. And as I said before, most people come out with at least $250,000 worth of debt, and some even significantly more, just for the 4 years of education. And that's largely due to the fact that schools, medical schools, are no longer subsidized to the same degree by state funding. So the challenge has been to try to create a way to increase funding to primary care so that the salaries begin to be more competitive with our specialist colleagues. And so there really has been a shift. There are additional dollars starting to flow. There's been very intentional efforts, particularly even in the Medicaid population is now for primary care is paid at the same rate as Medicare. Which is significant for primary care providers. So trying to increase dollars there. The other is to try to encourage loan repayment programs in underserved areas. Oregon participates in that. The definition of underserved is relative, and it usually means more rural environments, but as we've found even here in Lane County, you can have an urban environment that's actually underserved. And so we're examining what that looks like to try to be able to do that. and then supporting the primary care environment in as many ways possible to make the job that now has become much more broad than it was at one point more manageable for the providers that are going into those fields.
And I just wanted to add what Rick said regarding the Loan Repayment and Forgiveness Program. Now that Lane County is actually considered an underserved area, any primary care provider that comes to Lane County would qualify for one of the Loan Repayment or Forgiveness Programs.
Thank you. I'm Pat Farr. I'm the chair of the Board of County Commissioners, and as such, I'm the chair of the Health Board. Our table came up with a question, and I have a follow-up question for it. The lack of PCPs, is that a national problem, or is it more prominent in Lane County? And if so, why is it more prominent in Lane County? You've touched on this a little bit, but I have my additional question, which is mine, what can local elected officials do to help alleviate the problem?
So as regards the first question, it very clearly is a national issue in terms of the shortage of primary care providers. It is more dire in some sites than others, and Rick mentioned that in the rural areas of our country, not just of Oregon, the shortage is often more significant, but it's very clearly a national problem.
And again, as far as local legislators and local business leaders, again, is looking for those opportunities for partnership. And as we feel that it's really important to maintain a pipeline of primary care, and so the reality is that in communities that have primary care residency programs where they actually train in that environment, they tend to stay in that environment. So those that stay, that are trained in Portland, stay in Portland. So we hope that at some point we'll have that same capability here in Lane County so we can have providers trained and stay in practice in this area.
And I would say a way that any local elected official could help us is to help us with our advocacy efforts towards the congressional delegation in reinstating those funds to help start up a residency program.
Then just a touch of a follow-up, since you answered very quickly. The Board of County Commissioners is embarking on a strategic plan, which begins next week. And one of the points that I want to make on the strategic plan is specifically the CHIP, that it becomes actually one of our strategic priorities, the points of the CHIP. And I wonder if you could just briefly cover the points of the CHIP and then talk about if we make it a priority, what kinds of things can the Board of Commissioners do? And hopefully, I see Councillor Taylor in the audience also, the City Council and other locally elected boards.
So the Community Health Improvement Plan that the Department of Health and Human Services has put together with a variety of other colleagues, including Peace Health, United Way, and Trillium CCO, includes five main priorities, obesity prevention, tobacco prevention, health equity, health access or access to care, and then a combined priority around substance abuse and improved mental health. So those five areas. And again, that gets to this reservoir of patients that we are trying to provide care to. Persons who smoke need more health care per year than persons who don't. Persons who use substances that are illegal and cause significant health problems need more health care than those who don't. So these five areas deal with some of the upstream health issues that we can help hopefully prevent the size of that reservoir of patients and then do more with the existing group of providers that we have.
Hi, I'm Paul Thompson. I've been a City Club member on and off for the last decade. It seems like we're continually embarrassed when we pick up periodicals about the fact that the United States has one of the highest cost healthcare systems in the world, and yet it has one of the poorest outcomes of the industrialized nations. I wondered if you could each comment on why you think that is, and how is what you are doing here going to attack this fundamental problem?
You weren't kidding about the hard questions, were you? I really appreciate that you asked that question, because I think that those of us that have been involved in healthcare leadership, it is putting that mirror up to the United States healthcare system does make you want to close your eyes. The reality is that we spend, it isn't so much how that we spend a lot of money, it is really where we spend those dollars. And if you look at the where the dollars are actually allocated, currently the average is about 5% of the healthcare dollar goes to primary care. When we talked also about preventive care, Pat raises the constant issue that of the preventive care dollars, it's somewhere around 0.05% actually goes to prevention. So one of the challenges we have had is we have a healthcare system that incents activities or procedures or interactions that are a billable service. And so we spend a lot more energy on and time and resource on those things. And we spend a lot more on pharmaceuticals than other countries as well. So it really has to do with where the dollars are allocated. And we have built a system that is delivering exactly what it was designed to do. And that's to create very good care for very sick people. We do the best probably in the world at taking care of complex disease and significant medical problems. We do a terrible job when it comes to taking care of all the other issues, particularly how to keep us healthy.
So I would only add one thing that I don't believe, and I'm not running for office when I say this, but last year we spent $2.8 trillion on healthcare in this country, $2.8 trillion. By way of comparison, the highest ever military budget in this country in the year 2010 was $860 million. That was the time we were doing the surge and had two different wars. And so it's a huge amount of money, $2.8 trillion. I don't think we need more money in healthcare. I think what Rick said is exactly right. $2.8 trillion is a heck of a lot of money. If we as a society have decided that close to 20% of every dollar we spend is going to be going to healthcare in this country, good for us, but we better get what we want out of that 20% of our GDP. And we're not. So we just need reallocation. And I think that we have, with a chip, with the plans moving upstream, we have some good ideas on how it is that we can get more for our money.
And what I wanted to say is Trillium has invested nearly $1 million annually in prevention initiatives with a primary focus, at least initially, on obesity and tobacco use. And so what that is going to do is it's going to reduce two of the biggest healthcare cost drivers. And that's what Rick, or I don't know if it was Rick or Dr. Ludke, was talking about, the upstream efforts, which will have the downstream effects.
I'm a City Club member since 2006, and I just want to follow up on that by saying I was interviewing one of Pat's employees about preventing youth homelessness, and she mentioned that Trillium was one of the only groups that was actually investing in prevention. And they were helping with some of the education efforts they were doing. But education is my shtick. And so there's two pieces to this. One is the older my own children got, the more likely I was to be scolded for unhealthy behaviors. So I'm assuming, and they both went to public school, so I'm, more public education is associated with a higher level of awareness about what constitutes good health. But the other one is in recruitment. We hear all the time that it's hard to get professional people to come here because doctors are among those whose success is determined by education, not by birth. And our education system spends probably half of the national average per pupil to produce a pretty good outcome, all things considered. So the question is, to what extent have you, within the limits prescribed by your own positions, advocated at the state level for a higher proportion of funding for public schools so that we can begin to help you with this job of prevention and healthy living?
Great. I'll go at that one too. I really appreciate you bringing that up. And one of the wonderful things about and I'll go back to the CHIP and the four core groups that are really working with the CHIP have Peace Health, the county, Trillium, and then United Way. And it was very purposeful that we brought United Way in as one of the key members of that group because we understood that we had to connect to both the business community and education in order to actually affect the health of our population. And so even in Trillium's work, where we've done prevention work, the dollars, the vast majority of our prevention dollars are actually going into education. So we've started the good behavior game in the kindergartens. We've funded that. We also are looking at several different programs with Birth to Three and some other organization prior to getting kids ready to school. Because it turns out that the health outcomes and the health of that of a person is largely dictated by what occurs in the first few years of life. And so if we don't intervene at that level, we're always trying to treat the problem after it presents rather than prevent the problem. So your point is well taken, and that we are trying to advocate for that as much as possible, again, in Salem and in other locations as well.
That. So I just wanted to say that Trillium also is involved with the local Early Learning Hub, which here mm-hmm. we call the Early Learning Alliance. There are two of us with Trillium that serve on the governance consortium, and that hopefully is going to do what coordinated care is doing for healthcare for early childhood. But you made a very good point when the Chamber of Commerce and other organizations go out to recruit business to Oregon. There are three things that those businesses look at. They look at the stable economy in the region, they look at the healthcare system, and they look at education. So clearly we need to increase funding in K-12 education.
Okay, Frank Carlton, member since 2003. I noticed on one of your slides you did have DOs in there. As I understand it, Oregon has a new or relatively new doctor of ophthalmology or whatever it is up top. Anyway, and those folks, from my experience, tend to go into PCP more, and is that one area that is influencing hiring of new docs?
So I will speak to that one. We actually have two new schools of osteopathic medicine in our state. One is A.T. Still University up in the Portland area, and one is in Lebanon. It's COMP, the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific. And we in the county clinics have been taking students as part of their rotation. And one of those programs, the A.T. Still University, was recently approved by the federal government for a residency for family practice residents. And we've been trying to get those residents to set up a residency program down here as a hub. These are challenging times in healthcare, and it's pretty expensive to set up a residency, so it hasn't occurred yet, but we're actively working with that. Now, the second part of your comment was they tend to go into primary care. The A.T. Still University focuses on primary care and focuses on a pathway for their students and residents to go into not only primary care but community health center primary care. So as the chief medical officer of our community health centers, I'm very interested in getting a residency program with them and also getting their students to come rotate with us.
Okay.
Yeah, Trillium has been in conversations with COMP Northwest, which is the new DO school in Lebanon, so we're going to be very involved in those efforts to establish a residency program here for their students.
Another aspect of recruiting in a former city I was with, they recruit a lot of foreign doctors. And I don't know how we're working on that. It may not be a nice timing, but I imagine there are a lot of docs from Iraq right now who might like to emigrate.
We are clearly foreign medical graduates are a large part of the primary care workforce, and in that many tend to gravitate to those types of residency programs. There are some barriers and some challenges with foreign medical graduates, and there are a limited number of visa opportunities, and so we are working with our legislators and other groups to try to help see if there are ways that we can try to help that group stay in practice in Oregon. So clearly is a very important part of the primary care workforce.
Another person at our table wanted to ask about whether acupuncture is covered under these various programs.
Acupuncture is one of the services that Trillium covers, and specifically it's covered for the smoking cessation program. It's been very effective.
Lou Powell, City Club member. The City Club policy is that only members can ask questions, but we had a ringer at our table who has a complex question, and I'm going to pass it to her.
Thanks, Lou. I'm Chris Traver, and thank you for welcoming me today. I'm the Director of Medical Education at Sacred Heart Medical Center, and I work very closely with the OHSU and the Comp medical students for their undergraduate clerkships here. I also work very closely with schools in this state and around the country for PA and physician assistant and nurse practitioner placements, and it's very difficult to find those placements. So there's a lot of them that want to come here for their education. So do you have any suggestions, or do you see any way that we can work on incentivizing providers to do the training, to actually take these students? It adds to their day. It's not anything that's going to help them take care of their patients. And they're already busy, and they're already overworked, and there's a shortage. And so it's a little bit of a problem with those, because they're ready to start working as soon as they're done with their program. Thank you.
Chris, thank you. Again, I think that one of the key aspects of trying to create up space for physicians or others to actually do that training is really, it goes around the efficiency of the care model and how we're more effective. Right now, I think most primary care physicians and providers in the community feel very stressed and burdened with a lot of other responsibilities, whether it's paperwork or the complex needs of the patients. But trying to really bring on additional providers to sort of take offload some of that pressure, but also as we develop the care model where it's more balanced, it will free up the time that's necessary for adequate training. And our community has a very large group of primary care providers that have been very engaged working with OHSU and others to providing medical student training and also some experiences for residencies. But your point is well taken. It's a capacity issue, I'd say, at this point. It's not dollars. You're not going to dangle a carrot that's going to really help them to make that easier. It's really having the capacity and freed up space. One of the things we have looked at is trying to get our retired physicians, and again, more folks that are gone to part-time, that maybe have a little bit more time or and a capability to do that teaching. So that's one of the things that the team is looking at.
I would just add to that, I don't believe it's one thing. You could say that if we just took the heat off at the providers by saying, if you have a student rotate with you or a resident rotate with you, then you don't have to see 24 patients a day. We'll take the pressure off of you. I don't think it's just that. When I look at the challenges in my clinics, I have one clinic where it's almost 100% a facility issue. My current docs there only have two exam rooms. You know, most really high-speed, low-drag providers, they can fill up three or four exam rooms, and while one patient is getting their nebulizer treatment for their asthma, they're going on to the next patient, then they come back, and they're bopping around. You need an extra room when you have a student or a resident. We have that physical limitation at one of my clinics. At all of my clinics, we just moved to a new electronic health record. If you think of the frustrations you may have when you get a new phone, it drives me crazy when I get a new cell phone. It takes me a month and a half to learn how to use it. Well, it's 30 times more complicated than that, and that takes a huge amount of time. So I think it's a variety of individual, small, incremental steps to move forward, but we all need to do that.
Hi, James Baldock. I've been a City Club member since 2014. You may have partially answered my question, but I heard a lot of talk about residencies being expensive. The popular perception is that they're underpaid, overworked, young people. I was wondering if that popular perception is true or not, and what's the reality to these residencies?
Well, I think if you polled every resident, they'd say, yeah, absolutely, they're underpaid and overworked. I think that residencies have changed, and now there are a limited number of hours that a resident can actually be trained in a given week, so they actually have some limitations. In the old days, you just lived at the hospital for a week at a time. And so there are some limitations, try to make that a little bit more of a good balance. The pay scale has increased, but yet, again, it is a challenge. I'd say the biggest issue around the cost of residency isn't the cost that you actually are paying a resident to do the work. It's the cost of providing the facility, the training, the people that it takes in order to actually provide that education. So the salary piece is the smallest piece of any residency program, just because the teaching involved is costly.
John DeLow, City Club, and just a quick question. The shortage of doctors in this country is, like you said, nationwide, and as far as I know, it's been going on for a long time, even before Obamacare came along. Now that we have Obamacare, I'm sure it's even worse. Does anyone know if the federal government had even thought about the results of that? Are they going to start a program to help pay for the students that go into the practice?
There are a variety of conversations occurring in practice communities, and some of you may have heard of the 5% solution, mandating that every provider have 5% of their patients of a certain type, 5% of their provider panel is Medicare. There are practice groups in our country that see no Medicare, no Medicaid. They're closed to all sorts of different types of insurance. There are conversations occurring around what do we do with residency slots. The bulk of our residency training is paid for by the federal government in a variety of ways, some from the VA administration, some from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. How is it that footprint of money can be shifted such that it prioritizes primary care as opposed to some other super subspecialist? Everyone has a lobby, everyone has a conversation and an ability to prevent those things from happening, but those conversations are clearly occurring.
And I would say that we have a very engaged delegation in Washington, and many of us have spent time with our representative, and certainly Senator Wyden has spent a tremendous amount of effort looking at the complexities of providing the healthcare workforce. So we have people that clearly care about this, and not all states can say that.
I'll make one more comment. Sorry, Debbie. When I was in medical school back in the 80s, we had a panel of physicians from about a dozen countries come and talk to my medical school class. I don't remember who orchestrated it, but it was fascinating. And of the 8 or 9 European countries that showed up, none of them had a tuition for medical school. It was all free. So they got out of school with no debt. And interestingly, the one I remember the most was in Germany, which was then Western Germany. Not only didn't they pay for their medical school, but the person who spoke was an internal medicine doc. They were the highest paid specialist in the country. They prioritized primary care adult medicine, where most of our chronic diseases, where most of our cost of health care is. We certainly have high-cost kids, but overall, the massive cost is in adults. They prioritize that, and internal medicine docs in Germany make way more than fill-in-the-blank, neurosurgeons, ophthalmologists, whomever. So, you know, we can't do that at the local level. I think that's a broader community, a federal community conversation, but there are countries that have done it successfully.
And I just wanted to add that we also have a very engaged legislative representative group in Lane County, and particularly Representative Nathanson, Representative John Lively, and Representative Barnhart have been very helpful. They have attended meetings at Trillium to hear about the provider shortage and are offering some help with legislative fixes that I think will go a long way to help us increase access to primary care.
Dan Bryant, City Club member since 96. I'm interested in the health care for our citizens of the community who do not have homes and live on the street. And I think we are all aware that the cost of providing that care is typically very expensive because it tends to be a lot of ER usage. And I'm also aware of many studies that suggest that the housing first models save the healthcare system a significant amount of money. When you put someone into housing, they're not as sick, they don't go to ER. So I'm wondering, are there any efforts to look at how we can shift some of those dollars that are spent on providing that healthcare to instead to providing housing so that we in fact improve their health?
So I'll mention a couple things that the community health centers of Lane County are doing. And refer back to some of my early data. The CHC clinics typically have about 30% of the patients that are homeless and or uninsured. And now this year with the rollout of the expansion of Medicaid in our state, that number is dropping a bit because many of these people are eligible for Medicaid and they're being covered. But for the 10-year history of this organization, roughly 30% of our patients were homeless. We still see those patients, and one of the things we're doing now to really address that issue is we have a big O&E component, outreach and enrollment. So we're actively going out to try to find these people, get them enrolled in Medicaid, and help them get the health care that they need. This is actually funded through the federal government. We get a separate grant as part of our federally qualified health center grant to do this outreach and enrollment to this population. We didn't have that a few years ago. We dealt more indirectly with their homelessness, taking care of only their health issues, and doing less with connecting them into some of the facilities and some of the services out in the community around being homeless and getting them into a home or an apartment. But part of the outreach and enrollment is involved in that work. I also think it's important to notice or to note that as the numbers of persons covered by insurance go down, covered by insurance go up, and the numbers of the uninsured go down, we're going to see a shift in some of the patterns of care delivered in each of our facilities. In the community health center clinics, we're already seeing that shift. We've gone from 50% Medicaid to 60%, and that 10% drop was almost all uninsured in the past. And the other groups are going to see that, and that's going to affect, I think, resources available for other endeavors.
Well, and I just wanted to mention, too, that Trillium has partnered with Peace Health on a medical respite program with shelter care, and that is for patients who are being discharged from the Johnson unit. So if they're homeless, then working with shelter care to provide housing for them so that they aren't readmitted. And I'm going to let Rick talk a little bit more about that because I know he knows a lot more about it than I do. But I also know a little bit about the Housing First model and actually attended a meeting recently with Terry McDonald from St. Vincent de Paul. And right now, those discussions are in their very early stages, just infancy. So we'll be interested in hearing more and working with the community collaborative as that idea bubble moves forward.
And I think, again, as we look at the coordinated care model, the CCO model, the intention is to actually roll housing as a portion of that, understanding the importance of that as really a health indicator. We also, as we've made efforts to try to address many of the needs in the serious and persistently mental AL, which are a large have a larger percentage in the homeless population, is really trying to create an environment in which they're actually receiving the type of care that they need, where they need it, and when they need it. Again, because instability in housing is critical to being healthy. So without that, it makes it very, very difficult. And that's the reason for the respite program, because we know that the bounce back rate, we actually rent motel rooms for folks while they're in treatment for a variety of different things where they need IVs or a series of treatment, because we know if they go back out on the street, then we're gonna lose any type of effective treatment level. So we know the importance. Is it one program? No, it's probably multiple different ways of trying to look at creating a stable housing environment for really all of the residents of Lane County.
Jerry Smith, City Club member since 2003. I want to make a positive comment about everything. It all sounds like it's a big problem, but for some people, like a homeless person that I'm aware of, had a tremendous physical pain that came from an electric shock that broke his back and did all kinds of problems to his pain to all of his body. He was a student locally. All the money he got for student care went into pain medication until January 1st, when Oregon Health Program went into place, and now he has housing. He's also in a shelter care program at this point because of the extreme depression. So I think what's happened has a very, very positive effect for some homeless and severely disabled people. My flat-out question is, if you want to save more money for doctors, why don't you move heaven and earth to get single payer?
Mm.
It actually may require that movement. Yeah, it sort of could be all. Again, appreciate all of your comments and remarks. I think this is a challenge. We struggle to try to figure out all of the answers. Is there one answer? I'm not sure there is, but I think we have enough people engaged in the discussion now that realize there is an issue, and I think that that's encouraging. So I believe we'll get to a place where we won't be ranked in the 30s with respect to our health care for America at the highest cost. I believe that we can be top of that list.
And for right now, that's the system that we have. So we're working within it to achieve the objectives of the triple aim, which is better care, better health, and lower cost.
Thank you so much for bringing clarity and vision to City Club member program.
If you're interested in continuing this conversation, there will be a community conversation around this topic on Tuesday, June 24th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Springfield City Hall, which is 225 Fifth Avenue in Springfield. And maybe, Debbie, you could say a brief word or two about it as well.
So we're going to have updates from members of the Trillium Board regarding the work that we've done, behavioral health integration, new transportation benefits, dental. We also will have an update on the Community Health Improvement Plan that you heard about, and then a member of the Community Advisory Council. The Community Advisory Council is made up of 51% consumers and are really integral to our health reform efforts. We'll be there as well to provide an update. So we would love to see you and anyone who's interested in learning more about our efforts to attend.
And we'll probably ask you to come back and give us an update in a few months as well to see how things are evolving. So thank you so much for bringing clarity and vision to this program. Meeting the medical needs of Lane County's newly insured has been our title, and we've been talking with Dr. Rick Kincaid, Dr. Patrick Ludke, and Debbie Farr. So we'll meet again next week, June 27th, at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear Nancy Golden answer the question, what is OIEB up to? Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. And we're hoping to have the slides that were shown today up on our website as well. So thank you all very much.